I didn't know when I chose this topic that today we'd have two things, the King's Fund report on the still lack of funding for mental health services, and just, I think, the genuine non-understanding of clinical conditioning groups to actually prioritise mental health and, you know, the debate of whether we need more beds or more intensive services in the community. And I found it really upsetting this morning. There was a young woman on the breakfast programme this morning who had OCD, and she still felt obliged to refer to her OCD as a mental health issue. And I think this is part of our problem. I would have the issue word abolished around mental illness. If you've got mental illness, you've got mental illness. You should not be ashamed of it. You should be able to use the word. Because I don't think I would go to the doctor and say, I've got a breast issue. And I don't think the guys I'm being filmed would go to the doctor and say, I've got a testicular issue. They'd say, I've got something, I'm worried about it, I think I'm not well, I think this may be an illness, I need something doing about it. But the report that got buried in the King's Fund today was another report which was done by the Centre for Mental Health, which I'm privileged to be a trustee. And they've looked at one of the very well-established longitudinal studies that have been going on now for 40 years. And they've looked at what's happening to 8 to 11-year-olds. And I think it's very interesting. We've seen the recent discussion in Parliament where two previous Prime Ministers from radically different parties chose to bring the current Chancellor of the Exchequer and would-be next Prime Minister to book about tax credits for families. And the study that's just been done by the Centre for Mental Health shows, guess what, something that would not come as a surprise to any of us, that living in poverty is not good for a child's mental health at 11, and not for just lack of well-being, but for the early signs and symptoms of developing serious mental illness. So I think today became a sort of perfect storm. So if you're expecting high science today, prepare to be disappointed, and you can either leave or go to sleep or do something else. I believe very passionately, but robustly and with evidence base, that we have to be more in the centre of medicine to influence the whole of medicine. And by doing so, we will get a better deal for ourselves and our patients, but we'll also be able to support the rest of medicine, which is staring into the abyss of only being able to offer crisis care. So I do sincerely believe that psychiatry is medicine's secret weapon. So, and I do think this is about the long journey back to psychological medicine. So I was privileged to be trained at Manchester University, and I was trained in psychiatry by Sir David Goldberg, who'd left the Centre of Excellence at the Maudsley to come and do missionary work in Manchester. I genuinely believe he probably didn't know where it was. And he arrived there, and those were in the days, and there are some in the audience I know will remember this, when we were coming out of the asylums and new district general hospitals were being built, and attached, usually still down a mile-long corridor, would be the new brand new psychiatric unit, which was going to do brand new spanking social psychiatry. I was extremely fortunate to be trained by David Goldberg, and I'm swearing on camera, but it's what he said. And he said, well, Sue, he said, 4 days a week, you'll work with me on the inpatient unit and the outpatients. One day a week, I want you to bugger off and go and sit with a GP in a GP practice and learn about mental health as it comes through the door. He was absolutely right, and that was a good, always, I think, stood me in good stead, even though I went into a very specialised area of psychiatry. So, whilst I was president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, we had a Health and Social Care Act, about which some of us were not in agreement and opposed, but we got it, and there was an opportunity to do something there, and that was to introduce into primary legislation a piece of legislation which was parity of esteem. Sounds very quaint, it's a legal term, and it sounds a very soft term, But what I'd say to you is that you ignore primary legislation at your peril. If you can change primary legislation, it becomes a weapon and a tool by which you can improve services for your patients. So we got it enshrined in primary legislation, and that was by working with the voluntary sector and all the parties. So parity of esteem is the state or condition of being equal or on a level. Esteem is defined as to attach value to, or to think highly of, or to feel regard for and respect. Where did I find parity of esteem? When I was registrar of the college, Dinesh Bugra was generous enough to say, do you want to fly first class to Boston to go and do the Boston study tour, the Health Foundation of funding places? So I went. I listened to all this new sort of way of doing medicine for as long as I could. Then I got fed up. Being a child psychiatrist, I rebelled. I'm a little bit ADHD. And I went off to see the head of education in downtown Boston. And she talked about how she'd revolutionised the way, particularly ethnic minority groups, Hispanic children, she was getting them back into education. And I was really inspired by her project. And then she said, I'll just get security clearance. Do you want to come and listen to Obama? And I said, yes, please. And I went and I listened to him. And he talked about parity of esteem. And this came from the civil rights movement. And this was his mental health advisor. And of course, things haven't gone as well in the States as we'd wish, but there has been more attention paid to mental health. So the take-home message for those of you still in training is you never know when this bit of knowledge that sat at the back of your brain will come in handy. Because it was 4 years later, 3.5 years later, that I was able to use this and persuade the then government ministers that I would not believe that they told me, parity, yes, of course you've got it. Don't worry, you're not very pretty little head with this. You know, take our word for it. We believe that there's equality for mental health and physical health. And I chose not to believe them. I said, no, I want to see it in legislation, and we got it. So there are moments like that, and you don't have to be in a policy position. There are moments like that, I think, in day-to-day practice, where there is something you can bring forward that you know that will make a difference. And the reason I say that now is because the future of health services will be locally commissioned health services. And I live in Manchester, so I'm enjoying being part of devolution for Manchester, and I'll come back to the end of what I'm going to say. But that's what's going to happen. I predict next year that George Osborne will offer more and more regions in the country devolution. Why will he do that? Because it's a win-win. Because they're asking for it. So if he gives it them and they fail, it's their fault. If he gives it them and they succeed, it's because of him. So he can't fail on that. And that's just trying to put yourself in the shoes of others and how others think. And I've actually got quite a lot of time for politicians, but in the same way I have to understand, and you have to understand, what a diagnosis of severe mental illness means for the functioning of your patient set in the social context, you have to have the same sort of thinking when you think about politicians. I won't say what the diagnosis is because I'm on camera. So parity of esteem is best described as valuing health equally with physical health. You're in a range of ages here, and I don't know what you all do, but I guess you're all doing something to do with psychiatry. Anybody in the room not doing anything to do with psychiatry? Okay, what a shame. Wouldn't it have been nice to have somebody who was a surgeon in the room? So mental health would be characterised by equal access to the most effective and safest care and treatment. And in theory, that's what the new NHS is trying to do. But we were very behind on things. We didn't have waiting times. They're going to happen. NHS England are going to put waiting times in and we'll be able to tick the boxes. But whether that will make our care more effective and safe, I don't know. Equal efforts to improve the quality of care. We are definitely equal partners here, but we don't recognise it. We don't recognise it. Because if the rest of medicine is going to improve the quality of its care, it has to understand psychological medicine better, and we have to be able to help them. Anybody in the room a liaison psychiatrist? That's probably because you're in A&E, busy seeing somebody who's just threatened to kill themselves, or you're on a medical ward giving advice to a senior physician about medically unexplained symptoms. I'll come back to liaison psychiatry afterwards. The allocation of time, effort and resources on a basis commensurate with need. Well, we don't have those and we need to keep asking for them, even in a climate where we've been told that no more money will come to health. I do believe that if we shout loudly enough, backed by evidence, we may yet not do as badly as others in the forthcoming spending review. I'm on tape, so we'll see whether that comes to be true or not. But I do think it's likely that for the first time ever, David Cameron may even make a speech about mental health. That's something he's never actually done. That would be a major step forward, as the major step forward was four MPs saying, my name's Sarah Wollaston and I suffered postnatal depression. My name's Kevin Jones, I suffered from depression. I was seriously depressed whilst I was Minister for Defence. That sort of made people think a bit, but actually it made him focus. He had true black dog depression. Equal status within healthcare education and practice. This is not about a beauty parade of deans and medical schools saying, oh, well, we do 2 weeks of psychiatry training on our course, but they're gold standard 2 weeks, so that's as good as doing 2 months. There is a change there. The Medical Schools Council and the deans of the medical schools, because of our postgraduate deans, are beginning to listen to the need of to why we need more psychiatry in the curriculum. It's not just because they need to know about people with mental illness, how to understand it, treat it, and evaluate outcomes with evidence-based treatments. It's because if medical students come from day one think in a more psychologically minded way, they will achieve better outcomes for their patients. They will be less stressed out, and we know at the moment that we don't value junior doctors, and we know that they feel at an all-time low. And it will also improve the mental health of educational supervisors, because we'll get more out of what we're doing. So with my role in Health Education England, I'm on a mission to improve healthcare education for all in health and practically social care, because we're ending up doing a lot of training for social care. So just so you know, there'll be a whole suite of training coming out that's been developed by the Royal College of Emergency Medicine and our college through Liaison Psychiatry, which will be upskilling consultants and all staff in A&E to understand mental health problems better. But when I looked at the first tranche of the training they were going to do, it excluded people with learning disability. 1.3 million people who actually, when they don't understand what's going on and are frightened, act in a way in A&E that upsets other people because it looks challenging. And also, they weren't going to include personality disorder. Now, how many times do you go to A&E and you come to the conclusion that this person has been seriously traumatised from a very early age, and one of the consequences of not giving the right input for that child, adolescent or adult or even elder who don't disclose their abuse until they're 76, is that this has contributed them to developing a personality disorder which they've treated with substances. So you're nodding and we all know this, but we do not get this through to the rest of the system. So now there will be a module on personality disorder. I think they've given it a different name because they still feel allergic to it. And there will be a module on learning disability. So those of you who do sort of work and go over into Adam Brooks onto the general medical wards, I just wonder how many times they do actually look at whether a person with learning disability, whether they've read their passport or not. So there have been three recent coroner's inquests where, because the person with learning disability couldn't articulate what pain was like for them, they died. One basically died of constipation. They had a perforated bowel, died in dreadful pain of constipation. And another family that we're working with at Health Education England, their child had profound learning disability and autism. It was just as though they were invisible. Their temperature was rising. It wasn't it wasn't about verbal communication. They had an observable symptom, which was a rise in temperature, which equated to a deteriorating patient. The child was sent home and died. We need to explain to physicians why it matters and why we need to understand these things. Equally high aspiration for service users. Well, we know to our shame that as Mind and Young Minds have pointed out to us, even despite our best intentions when we sit in a clinic, we don't always have the same level of aspiration for a patient with schizophrenia as we would if we were in a clinic as a diabetologist. Well, they won't work, will they? So we know that Department of the DWP, we've got lots of issues there about getting people with mental health illness back into work. And we need to be able to explain to them, well, actually, the morning isn't a good time for them to have appointments at the job centre because they don't do well in the morning, partly because we've got a limited range of medication we can give them to keep them stable, which happen to have side effects, one of which is over-sedation still. So looking at medication and research, I'll come back to that at the end. Equal status in the measurement of health outcomes. So those of you who were working in liaison psychiatry, just watch the time, back in 2008-09, the physicians were the first to go to the payment by results system, where they had to say, this is the work I'll do, this is the money we think we need for it, and these are the outcomes we'll deliver. And they forgot that liaison psychiatry was a free service to them. And that's when liaison services, because they weren't funded, gradually faded away, and now we're trying to build them back up. We are at the health outcomes, and we're still having silly, tedious arguments about outcome measures. I can remember in 2000, when I was chair of the child faculty, going to a meeting of the great and the good, arguing about their outcome measure was better than the other ones. I didn't really care. They were all probably about good enough to measure something and to capture change, which is what outcome measures are about. It's capturing change. And we're still arguing about it, but we'll have to get on with it. So whilst I was president, we had in whole person care, we looked at parity, we looked at leadership for parity, and this is the real plea. I struggle with leadership. I think the one thing we lost about 15 years ago was doctors being willing or thinking that they should be leaders. And I don't think we were any worse in psychiatry than the rest of medicine, but we lost that. And I'm not saying that a lot of the things that have gone wrong in medicine wouldn't have gone wrong, but I don't think it helped. And I'm very keen that we get leadership back into mental health and the rest of medicine. And by that, I don't mean people training for many years to become a consultant psychiatrist and then feeling the only career for them is to be a chief exec or a medical director. I mean leading teams in small units, welcoming the new junior doctors so they understand what it's about, saying to the trust, don't send them off for a day's induction to learn about lifting and handling. We'd like them in the department to say, this is what this department does. We're a department that actually wants to do this. This is what we stand for. Tell us what you think we're like. Do you think we're depressed and we've got learnt helplessness? Or do you think we're a very lively department that are a can-do department that actually want to serve our patients best? Junior doctors are very good at feedback. Do we remember the days when junior doctors used to be there? When Royal Colleges did visits to educational placements, if you wanted to know what was going on in terms of not just education but standards of care, it was when you talked to the junior doctors that you got the real answers. We've stopped asking them questions now, so I think that's part of the reason they feel devalued. Parity of professional and public respect has to be earned. Parity of outcomes, preventing premature mortality. When I was president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, the Academy were really great. When my predecessor, Sheila Hollins, had been president of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, she asked all the other presidents what was good about psychiatrists and what use they were to her. So there were 21 of them. She got two responses. So I thought I'd ask the same question again. And I got 20 responses this time, and they were all able to say why we mattered and why we were important to them. One president from Scotland said, I'm telling you this, but I'd rather you didn't make it public. He was a surgeon. So what I'm saying to you, change does occur. Now, that's change at a level of policy and precedence, but is that change happening at the grassroots? I don't know. You can tell me. So parity of care and treatment, that's the strange system in which we now work. And of course, if you put up an act that where the turbulence that it causes can be seen from outer space, there will be a lot of chaos and distress and fear. And these bodies are only just beginning to come together, to work together. They were set up in primary legislation so they couldn't work together. That's what the legislation did. That's why it was bad legislation. They're now trying to find ways within the framework of the legislation to work together. So the Care Quality Commission has a tough job, and it's probably over-inspecting things that may not matter greatly and not able to inspect the things that really matter. So in terms of mental health, being able to inspect a whole mental health community alongside social care is what needs to happen, because if the local authorities strap for cash, you're not going to be able to get your patients out into safe care, particularly at a weekend. But it is beginning to change, and it's not all bad news. Okay. So addressing co-multimorbidity of mental and physical health, the Academy agreed, all the medical colleges said and told us what they thought we were poor at in terms of the physical health care of our patients. And we told them what we thought they were poor at in terms of the management of the psychological health of their patients. And three colleges have driven this: the psychiatrists, the physicians and general practitioners. And I've been chairing a group at our college to look at what we need to do to improve the physical health care of our patients. And I certainly think, you know, as medical students, we know how to do this, but genuinely, how much after that do we get up-to-date training on how to keep up-to-date with the physical health of our patients, at least to be able to identify physical health problems, and then to be able to know who to refer on to. So there'll be a report coming out at the beginning of next year, and then we're going to incorporate that into both e-learning, but also then into curricula. And the same for helping physicians understand psychological medicine and the importance. So we know that 40% of what comes through the door for a GP is mental health problems. And we know that 26% of bowel problems are actually got a psychological origin. Doesn't make them any less of an illness. But if those are the figures, if we were given a bit more support and a bit more enthusiasm, could help sort out a few things across the road in Addenbrook, so we know are now going through quite what could be described as an interesting phase in their life cycle. So rejoining the family of medicine, you get asked to do strange things when you chair the academy. It is all like family therapy. That's the only skill I've got, family therapy, and I just apply it to different groups of people. It happens to be a family of very important presidents, but it's still family therapy to me. And we were asked by the Secretary of State to look at accountable clinicians in hospital and the community, and you say, well, what's that all about? Well, actually, you should know when you go into hospital who your consultant is and who your named nurse is. The exception may genuinely be A&E when you have a lot of fluctuation and turnover. But still, the compliance rate in acute hospitals is 69% only, where a patient or a carer would know who their named consultant is. They didn't even bother to ask the Mental Health Trust. So we went even in the party until I insisted we went in the party, and we've got better figures. Accountable clinicians in the community sounds a very esoteric, and what's this got to do with psychiatry? There's a lot of conversation about us having to move from being specialists to generalists. And there's a lot of conversation about what the interface between primary and secondary care should look like. But nobody can iterate what it should be. And by talking about accountable clinicians in the community, I think we can actually bed this one and get on with it. And to me, what it means in most urban conurbations is having something that, if you're very mature, you'll remember, which were cottage hospitals. Small centres, which are now community hospitals, which are underused, where the vast majority of both general physicians, geriatricians, psychogeriatricians, patients could be admitted for brief admissions, where they didn't have to be seen as bed blockers in acute hospitals, where they didn't have to be at increased risk of getting infections, where they didn't have to be far away from home, and where secondary care doctors and primary care doctors could work together. But also, again, a past presidents, both Mike Shooter and Dinesh Bugra, wanted to bring in the concept of primary care psychiatry. But as members, you weren't ready for that concept. I think now's the time to bring back primary care psychiatry. So I don't mean community mental health teams. I mean psychiatrists and teams working alongside general practitioners in what are going to be federalised GP practices, where we can actually help not do the GP's job. They have a very specific, special role with their patients, but we can aid and assist. And so we've done some work on that. A parity approach to public health. There's going to be a lot of work done on that in the West Midlands. Do any of you know about atlases for variation? Okay, yeah, some do. Okay. They're quite powerful tools if you're a practitioner or if you're interested in getting some interesting population-based needs research done. So they're atlas of variation for many things, diabetes, cancer, respiratory disease, but there are some atlases of variation, and I've got an editorial coming out in the BJ site shortly, for mental health. And you can see how you sit alongside other places in the country. And, you know, it's a very telling tale, and there may be very good reasons why your outcomes are not as good as somewhere else. So Doncaster always comes out five times worse than the Isle of Wight. Well, if you think about the social context there, there are probably good reasons. But nonetheless, you can look at these atlases, you can see what you're not good at, you can have discussions with local authorities who are strapped for cash, but you can persuade them why it would be a good idea to actually give you some money. So I'll give you a practical example. So I chair this charity for Children and Young People's Mental Health Coalition, and to stay alive, because it's not sexy, we can't say we save babies. What we say is we influence politicians by lobbying with evidence-based information. So that doesn't trip off the tongue and give you lots of benefactors. So we do quite a lot of project work. And we did some joint strategic needs work. And as a result of that, I sat in a room when we presented the findings. I could see the police constable have a light bulb moment. He said, right, he says, so parent management training will reduce rates of antisocial behaviour, but the payoff will be in 2 or 3 years' time. I needed immediate payoff now. I will give to the local CAMS team £250,000 of my police money on one condition. On the nights that they do the parent management training with parents, they also agree to take in all these at-risk children and occupy them in some way in a single place, because if they're not on the street, they won't be committing crime. So you have to always offer, make the offer that will give immediate benefit, even though you know the main target you want is medium to long-term benefit. And several police forces across the country have now done that. They're giving money into CAMS if CAMS teams are bright enough to know how to get to the money. The same with ADHD. So there are ways of doing it. We need to move from risk to resilience, so we're very risk averse. And we need to build psychosocial resilience in communities. So the current research I'm doing is with Professor Richard Williams, which is bringing together the research on what we know about post-traumatic stress disorder in individuals, the research background to individual trauma. And we're linking that to the research that we know about disasters, because there's enough commonality now to tease out how you can build psychosocial resilience in communities. So this should be the big public health agenda. But I wonder how many of you feel, well, that's all very well, her standing up there spouting this, but actually I haven't got time to do any of this. So have any of you heard of books on prescription? Okay. So books on prescription, where the Library Association came to the college, and I didn't quite know why they didn't go to the psychologists and said, we've got all these books on the shelf in a library, and we nobody's ever sort of, you know, sense-checked them, made sure that they can't cause harm. So I grabbed this and said, yes, we'll do that for you. And we've done a lot of work with libraries now. But what I want to do, and the only place that's really taken it up with any attitude, is in Wales. What I wanted to do with the books in prescriptions for the libraries was also to get, preferably, forgive me for doing this, young, good-looking trainees, they don't have to be good-looking, but it does help, I promise you, to go into libraries and to stand up, and a bit like AA, to say, my name's XX and I'm a psychiatrist. Would you like to have a conversation about what psychiatrists do and what mental health's about and how you can keep your own mental health and self-manage? Now, it takes a bit of pluck to do that, doesn't it, to go in there? Because the minute I say that, you're feeling awkward, aren't you? But actually, by doing that, in quite a few places in Wales, the young psychiatrists have started doing that. They started having conversations with communities. Often now, if you look at communities, all these centres where people can meet are closing down, so libraries are often the only place you can actually meet. And they're starting to have conversations. And we've linked into Mumsnet, and they're encouraging this. So you just have to have a bit of faith about you can start with something. But the advice we're giving is evidence-based. We're not patronising the public. We're saying, well, here's a leaflet that's in a straightforward form. If you want more evidence, here are the references. If you want to have even more evidence, I'm afraid I don't know enough about it, but I can put you in contact with a professor who does. So you bring research right down the translational level. Okay, and DevoMank is a wonderful opportunity for us at the moment. It is difficult, but I think it is an opportunity for mental health. So I want to finish fairly quickly. So when we look at parity, it's got to be across the life course. We've got challenges of transitions, and I think one of the big transitions is always around early onset psychosis and what that transition should look like. Just so that you know, in Health Education England, we get mandates in Health Education England. We're at the end of the food chain when it comes to being told what to do. NHS England tell us what to do. Anyway, there was a mandate from the Cabinet Office that we had to look at improving training for early intervention psychosis teams. Those of you working in early intervention psychosis teams in their heyday some 14 years ago will know that they were well-resourced, well-staffed, and you were a protected community who could get on with the job. Now, we know that as patch teams have reduced in number, we're now struggling, and we've all been amalgamated into what I call mishmash teams. And the risk is that we lose our skill set. So we did a very quick survey across the country of early intervention psychosis teams, and I have to say I was depressed. So in some places they felt they didn't need a doctor at all. They could just ad hoc bring in the on-call doctor. Now, the clue's in the name, early onset psychosis, and we all know that presents in very myriad different ways. We found that what had been highly specialised nurses were now firefighting. You know, families were on the edge, there wasn't a bed, you know, we'll get you referred. So we've done the survey. So to cut a long story short, we have put the money out. We are contacting all the LETBs, all the clinical networks around early intervention psychosis. But what has to happen, your trusts have to say, yes, we want to join this party. And if you do, we will backfill. We'll give the money to backfill for staff. And we are offering to train staff to get skilled and reskilled up in the basic skills they need. So CBT, family therapy, more bespoke training on medicines management and improving the physical health care of your patients from day one. So the aim should be that nobody with early onset psychosis, who part of the treatment is medicines management, will put on any more weight than a woman going on the contraceptive pill. That should be your target, absolutely your target. Because we know that we just add to the burden of our physician friends if we get that wrong, and we really, really degrade the life of the patients we treat. So there's an offer there, but it has to be taken up in January. If the early intervention teams don't take up the offer, and that's why I'm saying it today, the money goes back in the pot and it'll go to, you know, knee surgery or something else, training. So please, please spread the word. So what does a good transition look like? I think this is really important work. I'd be interested in your thoughts because I want to do some learning around that and how you mix teams. Current threats to psychogeriatrics as a specialty is something that greatly concerns me. But we're ploughing on with the training in HE that is very much about training psychogeriatricians. Future in Minds is the child new report that's coming out. Connectivity across psychiatric specialties. Do we really give add-on value for money across the specialties when we know that what comes through the door often has multi-morbidities that involves not only lots of other medical specialties but across psychiatry specialties? I worry about the future of forensic psychiatry because we're seen as low volume, high cost, and the easiest way to save money will be to target forensic psychiatry. And I worry about the future of substance misuse services where so many now have moved into the voluntary sector. I'm not saying that's an entirely bad thing, but when you hear people running NGOs for people with substance misuse and then coming to me and saying, do you know, these people have a lot more different problems than substance misuse. I wonder what's the matter with them. I said, might be personality disorder. I do think that what we've got to do on the long journey back to psychological medicine is to find friends. And we've lots of friends we can find, particularly in paediatrics. So I don't know whether I've got any child psychiatrists in the room. or anybody thinking about doing child psychiatry. So anybody thinking about doing it, I'm hoping that with a fair wind that the dean at your college will be shortly advertising there will be a different way of training in child psychiatry. They're going to pilot it differently. You won't have to do as much adult psychiatry. You'll have the opportunity to do more paediatrics and get more experience because we've listened to what child psychiatrists have said that they think they need. It's a pilot. You cannot be disadvantaged. If the pilot doesn't work, we will guarantee you will not lose out and we'll bed you back into the system. We're going to fast-track liaison psychiatrists, so that's going to start very shortly. Working with primary care, I think, is critically important. Liaison and A&E I've talked about. But I'd like to talk about liaison psychiatry and what I think its three limbs are. And obviously it's working with A&E. Obviously it's working with physicians on medical wards or with paediatricians on child medical wards. But it's also working with general practitioners. And I think those three elements are actually different. And I think we need to relook at the balance that liaison psychiatry does. As I understand it, what quite often happens is that if, for instance, there isn't a perinatal service bespoke on your patch, the liaison psychiatrist ends up doing the work or somebody else ends up doing it. We're going to buttress perinatal. There's money in for perinatal. There will be, I think, probably two or three more perinatal units, but that won't be enough. The map will still look too red with not enough perinatal services. So there's going to have to be intensive community services around perinatal, and we're busy doing the training for that. So I'll finish. Whilst I was president, we brought in a sustainability fellow. I got in real trouble with the academic officer on the Royal College of Psychiatrists. He said, "What are you doing, wasting money on something as soft as sustainability? This could pay for, you know, a 25th, a randomised controlled trial." And I said, "Well, what use is that?" And I paid for a sustainability fellow who's finishing his PhD at Oxford. And that one person has had more influence on raising our profile across the medicine than I ever did as president. He was able to explain what sustainability was, why it mattered to all these arm's length bodies, why it mattered to the rest of medicine, because I think sustainability is misunderstood. So sustainability is about prevention. Don't get ill in the first place. So what more can we do to offer to public health that we can offer something in this field? And wouldn't it be nice to be let out of your clinic once a month to do something different out there in the community? Patient empowerment, if unwell, patient to self-manage where possible, but please, please, please to have the right to have an accurate full assessment and diagnosis before we decide they're safe to self-manage when all they're doing is going on to apps and and somebody's either not assessed them properly or they're not safe to be dealt with by having a self-help app. Lean service design, if health services are necessary, these should be efficient and high value. And that's most of the work that I'm currently doing, working with government and low carbon. And there's lots of wastage there. What we found was if you embed these four principles, we can use the internet to create online support networks, educational opportunities, peer training and mood monitoring. And we've got to get as heavily into this as the rest of medicine are doing. We've realised we've got a responsibility. There's a Climate Change Act, so every trust, one of their ticks is that they have to do something for carbon. So if you didn't know that, they have to do something. It's quite easy for mental health to give them that tick. Okay. So parity and funding. We opposed the public health cuts, and that was down to the Treasury. It was a piddling amount of money. It was £200 million. And a lot of public mental health prevention could have delivered a great deal of reward in terms of improving health generally. Parity in research, I think it can't be more of the same research. There's interesting research going on. We know that perhaps in psychiatry, the real potential is for repurposing drugs. I don't think there's going to be a lot of potential for new drugs coming on stream. Getting on with data despite the obstacles. We've got some of the poorest data collection in mental health. Getting research to connect with each other despite the sort of competition that inevitably goes on in research rounds and research assessment processes. Tackling inequalities, looking at the commonalities with the rest of medicine. Everybody will get famous and get a lot of money off MRC and Wellcome for doing well bespoke longitudinal studies in mental health or in any other branch of medicine. But what we need to do is to look at horizontal epidemiology, and we need to consider the dilemma of the patient. The patient does have a diagnosis, and we must never forget that, and that's core to our role. But it's the impact on functioning that actually matters. So if we think about it, you can have a brain tumour, you can have dementia, you can have intractable epilepsy, and the impact on functioning is not that dissimilar. You can have a stroke, so you know, either you don't think as well, you can't walk as well. So the functioning is very similar, the impact it has on you. But above all, the patient sits in a social context. They don't sit on a desert island. So anybody who can tell me what all those acronyms stand for, I sincerely suggest you go and get a life, okay? But this is the sort of thing that we're having to deal with day in, day out from trusts, because they're being pushed down from above as well. So this system feels completely repressed and suppressed and anxious and fearful, and therefore is risk averse and therefore becomes bullying. I'll finish on choosing wisely, although it's got a bad press. There's a paper coming out in the Hospital Services Journal, which I'm going to do a very robust response to. Choosing wisely came from the States, where you can have an annual whole body scan if you want. Why would you? So obviously, it wasn't difficult to find some things not to do in the States because they overdo, or they over sort of medicalise things there. We know that, except for those who don't get any healthcare at all. But it came to Canada. So the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges has started a Choosing Wisely campaign. Our college is looking at things, tests and interventions that we know are either not effective, are actually not in NICE guidelines, but we carry on doing them because it's far harder to stop doing something than to start doing something new. And we're going to look at those things, and we're going to help you to stop doing them, because it's easy to get a list of what not to do. What's difficult is to change your behaviour. And we're going to do that working with all the arm's length bodies, the voluntary sector, patients groups, everybody. We're going to learn how to have conversations with our patients again. And this is where you, above any other part of medicine, can help the rest of medicine about how to have a conversation with patients. Now, I'll hear you crying if you're married to a GP, but they only get 3 minutes. But if you could stop doing the things you shouldn't be doing as a GP, it would release up the 10 minutes to have the conversation you need to have with those that you need to have it with. Now, it's a leap of faith, but we cannot carry on delivering crisis medicine because the piggy bank is broke. We have to move to prevention, whilst not forgetting that those who've got illness have to have the right input, and the only way to do that is to change the way we behave. And that's some of the work we're doing at the Academy. We're looking at avoidable mortality, where they didn't want a mental health one in, but I'm getting one in the second round. Shape of training is going ahead. General capabilities and medical competencies will replace good medical practice. That's up on the GMC website. Improving physical health care, supporting the development of outcomes and metrics, and data sharing and data with utility. And all I can say is thank God for Dame Fiona Caldicott, who's bringing some sense into this and has been left picking up the mess that's been left about data and all the fears that patients and GPs have about it because it's been handled so badly. And I don't mind that staying on public record. So, lastly, we're calling for a learning disability challenge. I believe the dementia challenge did have an impact on the public's understanding of people with dementia. We want a learning disability challenge because it's great that we're going to decant everybody from Winterbourne View establishments, but I'm not quite ready, the public's ready to receive all these people with learning disability and challenging behaviour into the middle of your village or your town or your city. I wrote a letter on behalf of the whole academy, every college signed up to this, to Jeremy Hunt, whose civil servants wrote me a wonderful letter back telling me the 34 things they were doing for learning disability. So I wrote back saying, that's brilliant, but you're missing the point. What we want is the public and everybody else to understand what learning disability means, for them to have their rights not just up in legislation, but to have them respected in day-to-day life. And that will not be solved by the 34 things you've listed. How many people at Addenbrookes in general medicine or A&E would know to ask for a person who's got learning disability to look at their passport? You know about LD passports? Okay. But how many people in A&E would just be saying, I'm finding this person a bit strange, they're not communicating with me, or just relying on the person who came with them? So people with learning disabilities should all have a right to a passport where they explain what they've got wrong with them and how they like to be communicated with. The same way you can do that with people with got profound deafness. And I do think the way forward is for us all to hold our own health records and be able to have an accurate conversation with those who are there to help us. I'm going to call out obviously to our college. I hope you would support a learning disability challenge, because I'm not going to let go of this one. So there we are. So it wasn't an academic presentation. I never mean it to be, because I think de facto I'm a social scientist. That's the sort of scientist I am, and I'm, you know, quite happy and proud to be a social scientist, because I think we've got a very valuable role to play in improving health and social care generally. So I've left time for discussion, so I hope you'll have a go back at me, because otherwise I won't feel I've done my job properly. So thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.